ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
The world right now is a disaster. It's easy to feel helpless. But there was a moment when millions of people around the world said enough. I'm Sisson Kim Simong. Join me for Boycott, the fight to end apartheid, how Australians joined others around the world to push back against racism and won.
Whites only teams, we thought that to the average Australian, that would be despicable.
Boycott, the fight to end apartheid. Search for ABC Rewind on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Look, today on ABC Radio National's live event show, Big Ideas, if you live with a serious mental illness or a loved one does, how do you feel about the way the illness is covered in the media? Where does the media succeed? Where does it fail? And when can it get complicated? The media has certainly played a role in reducing stigma when it comes to mental illness, helping more of us get support, get treated, suffer less. Crucially, it's also exposed the urgent need for more mental health services in Australia. But the media still does real harm. It can exacerbate stigma. It can sensationalise. And one of the most complex, gnarly areas to cover is what happens when serious, untreated psychosis becomes associated with violence. To be clear at the outset, the fact is people in the throes of psychosis or schizophrenia are more likely to harm themselves than others. But there's more to the story, and on Big Ideas, we are all about nuance. So we're taking you today to a public event at the University of Melbourne. Let's meet four people well-equipped to have this conversation. Tim Heffernan is acclaimed for his lived experience, leadership and human rights work. He's chair of the advocacy organisation Being Mental Health Consumers and former New South Wales Deputy Mental Health Commissioner. Gail McNaught runs Stigma Watch at SANE Australia. It works directly with media organisations when coverage goes off the rails. Dr. Anna Ross is a senior research fellow at the Melbourne School of Population and Global Health, and hosting the conversation in NAM Melbourne is Dr. Chris Groot from the Melbourne School of Psychological Sciences at the University of Melbourne.
Thank you. Okay, so I'm going to set the scene briefly. Tonight we're going to be talking about schizophrenia, about psychosis. Schizophrenia indeed is a mental disorder that is defined by the experience of psychosis. And when I say psychosis, unless you are in the know, you might think that psychosis or psychotic disorder is another way to say this, means violence and dangerousness. But that's not what psychosis means. The term refers to a difficulty in connecting with reality, contacting reality, an impairment in reality contact. Psychosis and schizophrenia actually involves a constellation of experiences. And rather than tell you about these experiences myself, I think it's far more appropriate that we look to our lived experience expert, Tim, here. And so, Tim, if maybe I could begin this evening with the first question to you. We're certainly grateful to you for sharing your lived expertise. We've just been talking about this term psychosis and schizophrenia, but can you tell us about what the experience of psychosis and this reality contact problem or the experiences you would care to share it is actually like?
You know, I think I'd probably like to reframe the definition somewhat and take it out of the context of it being a problem as being a centering thing about psychosis. You know, I know of one psychiatrist, Henry Stack Sullivan, I think it was his name, who saw psychosis as an extra human dimension. People who experienced a psychosis were more human than other people. And in a way, it's not so much a disconnection with reality as a connection with other meanings and deeper meanings often. And I think part of that also is problems with looking at it in a generic way, because psychosis, my experience of psychosis is very different to every other person's experience of psychosis. It is a deeply human, it is a deeply individual experience of the world, of often your development from adolescence into adulthood, coming to terms with not just the news, but the world that we live in, which is complex, difficult, getting more complex and more difficult to live in, to relate to in the ways we expect, the ways we categorise as normal. You know, so, you know, my experience of psychosis, I think the news was important when I was 23, left teaching, bust up a relationship. It was Star Wars. Ronald Reagan was the president. It was the downing of KAL-007, Korean airliner over Russian airspace. There was a lot going on, the invasion of Grenada. And I hooked into a space where, as typical with my psychosis, I was going to save the world. That experience gave me the diagnosis of schizophrenia, which is diagnostic ways of looking at things I now question. I was re-diagnosed sometime later with bipolar 1 mood disorder. So my psychosis is always associated with a movement into what we call hypermania, which is a heightened, elevated relationship with the world, to mania, which is a further heightened state. I've had 8 experiences of hospitalisation, some voluntary, mostly involuntary, but always supported by my family, my wife, my mother previously, to get there. But, you know, I think, as I said, my experience of psychosis in 1983, at that time, you know, 6 years later, I read about an operation on the German border called Abel Archer, if you look it up, and it was one of the times we almost slipped into World War III. It was a really heightened state during the Cold War. And it was the exact same time of my first psychosis. That's probably a coincidence, but I'm trying to communicate often there are deep meanings in psychosis. And we tend to ignore that, and we tend to go down the generic treatment regime where people have a life of tranquilized sensation. And we wonder, and often a treatment that involves violence, as my treatment did as a young man, seclusion and restraint, that positions you to run away from the people, the services that might allegedly help you.
Yeah. I'm always grateful to be learning from you, Tim, every time we meet and collaborate. And I think what you've just really highlighted there is so poignant. The experience is incredibly complex and incredibly deep. Even at the clinical or scientific level, we're thinking, you know, with a lot of complexity, and that's where I come from. But then the experience and the meaning is so many more levels of depth. And this is important to understand the complexity, to understand the different ways in which people experience psychosis, because when we think about our topic tonight, and the way that media might represent psychosis, there can actually be quite a much more simple and problematic picture that's painted. Anna, I might pose you a question next. So you've obviously got a very significant stream of research in understanding the way in which Australian media reports on psychosis and how that can be improved. Before we get to the solutions, what are some of the trends that you have seen in your research in news stories in Australia involving psychosis?
So what we tend to see when it comes to media portrayals of people who live with schizophrenia or psychosis or, you know, other types of complex mental illness, as Tim was saying, that might involve psychosis, we tend to see these illnesses most commonly represented in relation to violence and crime. And what makes this most problematic is that we know that that's a gross overrepresentation of the violence attributable to mental illness. So we know there is a small link with untreated psychosis. I think we'll go into that later, so I won't delve into that now. But it's not, I guess, yeah, representative of the actual rates that violence is perpetrated by people who live with any mental illness. And then I guess also the flip side is because with the overrepresentation of, I guess, these like quite negatively framed stories, we don't hear enough of the positively framed stories of the experiences of most people who live with a complex mental illness. And then, yeah, that's not really part of the conversation or what the general public are exposed to.
So much a much more simple and problematic picture being painted. Gail, if I could come to you now, you lead a wonderful initiative by Sane Australia called Stigma Watch. And in that work, you have got unique oversight of everything that's happening in Australia in terms of reporting around mental illness and particularly schizophrenia and psychosis. What are some of the things that you see? What are some of the qualities maybe of problematic headlines and stories that you see?
So for those who might not have heard of Stigma Watch, it is a world-leading program, I'd like to say. It is, of course, my baby, so I'm going to talk it up. But it was one of the first programs in the world to actively address stigma perpetrated through media, which is very much a main driver of public stigma in communities like we see in Australia, because people gain a lot of their attitudes and behaviours from what they see and hear on the news. So Stigma Watch was developed, I think it's about 25 years ago. It was actually formed immediately following the Port Arthur incident, actually, in response to governments and also media coming to saying, how can we kind of portray this in a sensitive manner? What are the facts around this? Because so little was known back then. So Stigma Watch has been running for about 25 years. We partner with an organisation called Mindframe. Mindframe are responsible for developing, they're also a world-leading organisation. We're very lucky in Australia, actually, in terms of the stigma reduction programs that we have here compared to other places. Mindframe develop a series of evidence-based guidelines that kind of not dictate so much as guide the best practice for journalists in reporting in different aspects of mental health and suicide. The wonderful Anna Ross has one of these guidelines with Mindframe that is specifically around reporting on psychosis and violence. So what we do twice a day is we go in and we monitor media and we identify articles or podcasts or TV news or even performance plays that might have an element of stigma or harm as part of what they are saying. And we approach them very respectfully, very gently, and provide them with advice as to how they can improve the way that they're communicating. It's not mandatory. It's not something that reporters have to respond to. But at the moment, you'll be excited to know this, Anna, we're sitting at around a 60% response rate. So we're actually getting around 60% of the articles that are already stigmatising change to be less harmful. We operate a little bit in the shadows. We don't like to hold people up and say, you're doing a really bad job. I mean, there are some journalists that I would like to hold up and say, you're doing a really bad job. But what we find more often than not is that the media are actually really receptive to what it is that we are telling them. In the case of psychosis and schizophrenia, for obvious reasons that we'll talk about a little bit later, it has had a bit of a moment in the sun in the media. So we are seeing a lot more articles that refer to psychosis and schizophrenia than we probably did prior to what happened in Bondi Junction. There is very clearly a connection, more often than not, the vast majority of stories affiliated with crime or some kind of criminal element, whether that it's something that involves police anyway, might not necessarily be violence. What we often see is the use of highly stigmatising language. You know, you'd be very unlikely to see someone, if there's a high-profile person that's talking about their experiences of depression or anxiety, you'd be very unlikely to see a highly stigmatising headline associated with that. That is not the case if they are writing or talking about a situation that's involved someone experiencing schizophrenia or psychosis. The other thing that I find quite interesting is part of the Mindframe guidelines is the addition of help-seeking information. You will often see that when you read an article that might refer to mental health or suicide, you will often see Lifeline or Beyond Blue below that article. And that's some really important work that Mindframe does, and Stigma Watch also goes in and ensure this is the case, to provide those help-seeking options. Very rarely do you see help-seeking options linked with stories that are around schizophrenia or psychosis, which is interesting. And I can't, you know, the scientist in me can't give you any precise reason why that is, but I suspect it's because there's this kind of perception that maybe either they don't need help or that help isn't going to help them kind of thing, which again, stigmatising, completely not true at all. I think the other thing that we see very rarely in articles and media stories that are around schizophrenia and psychosis, and it touches very heavily on what Tim was saying, is we don't see a full person in these stories. Again, if someone's talking about their experiences of more mild to moderate or kind of mental health conditions that we maybe are more familiar with, you'll see a full story. You might see them with their children. You might see them at work or, you know, talking about their hobbies. you don't see that with people with more severe or complex mental health conditions. We don't get that full person. We don't hear that they are an amazing poet. We only hear that perhaps, you know, they were picked up by the police in a certain situation. So the media reporting in these situations is definitely skewed towards kind of one dimension, and we don't see the truth, I suppose, in the person.
Thank you, Gail. You've got such an incredible oversight of what's going on in the country. Anna, I'm wondering if I can ask you then, given everything that Gail's been describing about the problematic features of news reports that aren't balanced, ethical, accurate, and so forth, what happens to the general public when they consume this news?
Yeah, I guess it's the natural progression, really, then, isn't it? And it's probably no surprise to hear that, you know, if exposure to such, as Gail was saying, one dimension of people who live with schizophrenia or psychosis, that it has quite a negative impact on attitudes and behaviours as well. So we know that these types of portrayals act to perpetuate inaccurate stereotypes, including stereotypes about people with schizophrenia or psychosis being dangerous, being unpredictable, as people who should be feared. And we know that, you know, these attitudes then go on to influence behaviours, and that can include like desire for social distance, so not wanting to socialise with people who live with complex mental illness. And, you know, that results in social exclusion. But we also know that this can then influence more structural stigma. And Tim will probably speak to this much better than I can. But we also know that this impact flows on into stigma experienced in employment, in housing, in law enforcement, lots of different facets in life, which is, really unfortunate.
Dr. Chris Groot from the University of Melbourne's School of Psychological Sciences in conversation with Dr. Anna Ross from its School of Population and Global Health, Gail McNaught, who's manager of Stigma Watch at SANE Australia, and Tim Heffernan, who is a lived experience leader and mental health advocate. You're with ABC Radio National's Big Ideas. I'm Natasha Mitchell. Now, so what does an accurate, ethical and compassionate approach to reporting on mental illness look and feel like?
So this is a really big problem for the proportion of the public who don't live with psychosis. But as well, Tim, can I ask you about how these problematic news stories affect people living with psychosis? I imagine you've heard a lot from the people that you work with who have lived experience.
Yeah, so these stories, I think, make people angry, which is a human emotion that doesn't necessarily lead to violence. People can try to articulate that anger as we do, but it's often very difficult to get that across or to be heard. I think you have, from my experience, and psychosis is intimately related to trauma in people's lives. You know, it's not locked into a brain disease, which schizophrenia has seen, where people's capabilities regress. You know, I was told, you know, if you have too many episodes of psychosis, your brain will start to shrink, Tim. You know, I was told, you know, well, this is a, as most of us were told, this is an imbalance of chemicals, and just take this pill to balance it up and stuff like that. But in reality, most people, and I've been involved in the Hearing Voices movement for probably 15 or more years, and help run a group in Wollongong, where I come from in New South Wales. People retreat to their community, so they'll gather with people, with their peers, who also experience psychosis, and they will feel lesser. They will take on what we call self-stigma, I think, if we use that term, where those stories impact on them and can re-traumatise people as well. So it has an impact. The best thing about the Hearing Voices movement, for instance, is that we talk about voice hearing. We talk about people's experiences. At different stages, people can interrogate voice hearers with a Maastricht interview, for instance, where we can learn about where the voices might have originated from, what's behind the paranoia that a person might be feeling, you know. But I think the anger is we only hear these stories. You know, we don't hear the stories of friends who have experienced psychosis and might die by suicide because they're running from care that's been traumatising. that's not there. They're running from a system that treats psychosis in a coercive way. It says, if you've got psychosis, we have to stop that. We have to treat that. We don't explore that at all, hardly, you know. Mm. And, you know, we have, you know, in Melbourne here, we've got magnificent poets like Sandy Jeffs. We've got magnificent people with schizophrenia, with, you know, all these labels, schizoaffective disorder, bipolar, whatever it is, doing tremendous things with film and theatre, you know, and writing world's best memoirs like Heidi Everett from around here. You know, we have to celebrate the lives of people who live with different beliefs, who live with altered states, a different relationship with their community, not make them feel they have to retreat from the world because they're not welcome in that world.
So I'm hearing there is a profoundly negative impact on people's lived experience, and that I think I'm also hearing in there that in many instances the current system is not adequately meeting the preferences and the needs of the diversity of people with lived experience of psychosis and experiences in this space, and that community-driven initiatives like the Hearing Voices program and so forth create an empowering, self-determined, safe space for people with lived experience.
Yeah, and, you know, just quickly, you know, the system is designed to work how it does, and it's designed around fear. It's backed up with archaic and coercive mental health laws. It treats people as lesser, and because the system does that, society does that too.
That's really setting the scene for people to withdraw from standard paradigms of care, if you would.
Relationships and connections and family and community.
Yes. Mm. And so there's a lot going on then. You were mentioning all of the brilliantly talented people who happen to live with psychotic experiences, but we never see those news stories coming through. We see a strong bias to the negative. We do see, as you, Anna and Gail, as you both pointed out, this strong, systematic, decontextualized pairing of psychosis and violent crime. Now, I'm not a forensic psychologist. The only thing I will say is, based on my consumption of the empirical literature, recent very large-scale meta-analyses, systematic reviews highlight important details. There's a complex story here. And that is that whilst there is, statistically speaking, an elevated risk of violence in psychosis, the absolute risk is very low, and there are many factors that are at play, such as substance use, housing difficulty, relationship difficulties, financial, a range of factors that contribute to violence in this space. The media, I suspect, may paint a picture where we think everybody with psychosis is probably going to be dangerous, when in fact we're talking more about, you know, very, very low percentages of people, aren't we, Anna?
So I think, like, from the studies that I've looked at, Chris, from what I can see is that mental illness can account for about 4 to 6% of the violence that occurs in the general population. But what we are seeing, I've got to say this earlier, what we see is, and the media of, you know, violence linked to people with complex mental illness is much higher. So in the Australian media, up to 50% of news stories about people with schizophrenia feature violence. But I said, when that actual, you know, I guess, yeah, population attributable risk is far lower.
Tim, this is obviously a really difficult discussion, and I'm so thankful that you've joined us. I'm aware that you provide some really meaningful support to people around you who are living in forensic mental health care settings, for example. Can you tell us a little bit about that, your experiences of supporting people who have ended up in an incident involving violence?
You know, I think the most important thing is that I have friends with a forensic history who live in the community. And that's really important, because that's where people need to live, not in forensic hospitals. So I visit the forensic hospital in Sydney each month as an official visitor, which is under the Mental Health Act. We go in and talk to help advocate for people, etc. and have had a bit to do with the forensic care peer workforce. Myself and Leanne Craze were involved in a review of the peer workforce at forensic care. All of the people who are in forensic orders are human, beautiful people, gentle mostly, and have done some pretty terrible things when they've been unwell. But I want to go back to the peer thing, because I think one of the big things with this, and I have a friend who I used to be a peer worker for in the one of the Sydney hospital, and he heard his dad to go into the hospital, but it was around a system breakdown, you know, and it was around a mismanagement of his medication and inadequate care, I suppose, from the community mental health team that led his psychosis to get to that stage. So I can say it happens, you know, but the big thing in my mind is that we, and I don't know what the statistics are, but with that idea that we tranquilise everyone who has psychosis, we're dealing with major tranquilizers, antipsychotics, as the front line of treatment. And, you know, and all the side effects of those, the way they make people feel half human, not having emotions, not having sex life, everything in that, and they come off it, you know, and have problems. Is it a, you know, often I think there's a rebound effect coming off as much as the illness itself. But other, you know, what I like to see, and I think it works really well in the forensic setting, is peer support. As people move from the hospitals into the community, it's essential there that people with a forensic history can be helping people in that space. There's a lot of that done in the States. It's probably not done anymore. It's probably been turfed out by now. But, you know, I think the thing is, if you can have connection, if each person with a mental health, with psychosis, can have a connection, a human connection that's there, then I think they would be much less likely to offend. It's one of those things we can do. A lot of people with mental illness who've got psychosis exist in poverty, so they spend a lot of time in their flat, in a room, not going out or not doing anything, not having a life, not having relationships. We're setting people up, I suppose, is the thing, you know. And as I mentioned before, a lot of people's experiences of mental health care, when it's under the Act, is a violent one, that you're the recipient of violence that's sanctioned by the government. Your personal autonomy is stripped away every time they flip you on your tummy and give you an intramuscular injection. And, you know, it's just, I think, obviously the use of violence, of seclusion restraint, needs to go, and that includes in forensic hospitals. You know, if we deal out violence, we can expect violence.
And so it sounds like there's some, you know, significant gaps and problems with the system and the standard models of care, and peer roles play such an important role in filling some of those gaps and providing that connection you were speaking with and providing that compassion. And one of the things that I've been reflecting on after we've had conversations where you've told me about your experiences and providing the support is that the proportion of people who have engaged in violence and have been involved in a forensic incident whilst experiencing psychosis, quite often, based on my experiences around stigma reduction internationally, tend to be othered as another group of people who are not part of the group of people who experience a mental health problem. This is something other. Let's not give those people compassion, when in fact, if I think about somebody who might have experienced psychosis, done something that, you know, is terrible, and then later on have gained insight into that when they've been in recovery and so forth, and then have to come to grips with that. That's, I find that incredibly heartbreaking, incredibly deserving of compassion.
Taking the stigma out of media reporting on mental illness. Our theme today on ABC Radio National's Big Ideas with me, Natasha Mitchell. And joining us are Dr. Anna Ross from the Melbourne School of Population and Global Health at the University of Melbourne, Gail McNaught, the manager of Stigma Watch at SANE Australia, and mental health advocate Tim Heffernan, who has lived experience of mental illness and uses it well in his advocacy. The moderator of this conversation at the University of Melbourne is Dr. Chris Groot. Now, what happens when mental illness and violent crime become entangled in the same news story? This can sometimes be the case, as it was in the Bondi Junction tragedy, that horrific mass stabbing event at the shopping centre in Bondi in April 2023.
So I think what we're establishing here is quite a complex story that most people living with mental illness, psychosis, schizophrenia, are not violent, but there are circumstances and factors that align, that feed into an elevated risk of violence, though the risk, again, is still overall very low. Of course, high-profile events have hit our television screens, most recently the Bondi Junction incident, and Gail, you mentioned also Port Arthur and the Bourke Street Mall. But maybe using the Bondi Junction as an incident, Gail, if I could ask you as an example, what do we know about the news stories when something like that happens? How do they unfold? Is there a particular pattern? Is there a certain style? What do you see?
I think the first thing is to reinforce that these are rare incidents. Mm. You've mentioned three incidents over the space of 25, 30 years. They are rare incidents. Unfortunately, what happens with these incidents is because, you know, the media get involved, they become very big. I mean, obviously the Bondi Junction incident was quite... They all involve people's lives. So there's a perpetrator and then there are also victims there. But the media portray them as very black and white. That's the bad person, these are the good people. And I think, you know, in previous media coverage, it has been very, never the twain shall meet. That person is a bad person and they have a diagnosis and therefore they should be locked away. And we, you know, their problems are their problems. They're not, you know, they're not doing what they should do about it. And so, you know, the victims over here they're the ones that kind of are focused on. I actually found the Bondi Junction incident reporting to be quite interesting. Anna and I have done a little bit of a research project on it that we will be publishing as well. But we had quite a distinct story arc that we saw. I mean, obviously at SANE, we play a dual role. There was the stigma reduction where we were working very closely with the media. But what we also saw is as an organisation that supports, that, you know, we're a community of people with complex mental health needs. So we were also very focused on supporting that community, both individuals with psychosis and schizophrenia, but also their families and loved ones and kin as well. In fact, I think the most calls that I got during that week were from family members as well. And I think it also needs to be kind of flagged before I go on that there were people that lost their lives in that incident. And there are people who have probably got ongoing mental health kind of conditions as a result of being part of that incident. You know, it was a horrible thing to happen. But from a media perspective, I think there was a couple of key things that influenced the way the story went. The first thing was, obviously, it happened in a very high-profile situation in central Sydney. Now, anyone that's ever worked with media before will know that the most media coverage you will get is if it's close to a media outlet. So the journalists were there straight away. It happened on a Saturday, which means that you don't probably... didn't have the more experienced journalists rostered on. You had people that were rostered on the Saturday afternoon shift. So I would suspect that some of the journalists that were immediately called to the scene may not have been people that would have had familiarity with mental health conditions or complex situations like this as well, and were coming at it from a very strong kind of sensationalist angle. And that's really what we saw for the first couple of days. The thing with media is they walk a very fine line, and everyone would have seen this. You know, no one said the word schizophrenia in those first 2 days, but it was heavily inferred. But because nothing had been confirmed, there was just a lot of kind of edging around the outside. There was kind of a focus, I suppose, on the alarmist side of it, the violent side of it. And then what we saw, which I think is actually a relatively unique situation, is we saw the family of the person who the perpetrator get involved. And that interview, I think, actually changed the trajectory of the story quite significantly, because the interview that they gave, where they confirmed what his diagnosis were, but they made him so human and they made themselves very human, and the media covered every part of that. And so what we saw from there was a little bit of a shift in the story from alarm, 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 to, you know, this is the situation that this person has come from. And as the story continued on through the week, what we saw is, and I found this quite a positive thing, more exploration of the factors that might have been involved. There was discussion of his homelessness. There was discussion of his challenges with obtaining connected and consistent care, both himself and his family. There was discussions, you know, it led into some, and I mean, it probably also was a bit of serendipity that a lot of this happened when there was a lot of issues around emergency and psychiatric care in New South Wales. So that kind of really led into much more of an exploration of what is going wrong with the system, actually, that this kind of situation had resulted in. So whereas previously we saw very much, you're a bad person, you should be locked away, I found the media to be a lot more open to looking at some of these contextual factors. I think the role that Stigma Watch played in that week and Mindframe as well, together we did a lot of work behind the scenes with journalists. We tried to get on the front foot. We put media releases out. We spoke actively with journalists. I think the one thing that sticks in my mind from that week was I had a phone call from a journalist from a News Corp outlet that shall not be named. And this journalist said, hello, my name is whatever. I'm contacting you from this outlet. I need you to tell me why everyone with schizophrenia shouldn't just be locked up. That was exactly how the conversation went. And, you know, we had a really great conversation. It didn't start well, but by the end of it, I feel like we kind of nutted it out. And I think what that journalist was showing us was coming at it from that very blunt, why should the general public not think this? And the story that came out in the end was actually, it was quite nuanced for a News Corp story. It was quite nuanced, and it wasn't as sensationalist as it could have been. So I think what we really saw there was a lot of open hearts from the media, actually, in terms of learning a little bit more about the situation and being open to kind of exploring some of that nuance that we might not have seen otherwise. And I do feel that maybe having the involvement of the family was part of that. Something else that I just wanted to quickly touch on from what Tim was saying as well is one of the things we tried to do during that week was put as many people up that had a lived experience of psychosis and schizophrenia to media to share their story. And one of the hardest things about these conditions being so stigmatised is that self-stigma. It's self-perpetuating. So people who might think, you know, I want to share my story, but I know how I'm going to be treated if I do, which means we don't see people in the media because they're not comfortable standing up and sharing their story because of the fear of what they might be exposed to. We were very lucky that we had a couple of amazing peer ambassadors that stood up, even though they were quite fearful. One, in fact, was seeking employment at the time and he called me and said, I've had a big conversation with my wife and my child and my parents and I've decided this is too important. I can't be frightened here. I need to stand up and share my story. And he did an amazing feature for us in Fairfax across Australia where he spoke about his experiences of psychosis. And we also had the indomitable Sandy Jeffs stand up as well and share her story. So the more comfortable we can make people with sharing their stories, the more comfortable we are with people who share these stories.
So it sounds, Gail, like through your work in Stigma Watch, you actually have really good success working with journalists, yep. Very receptive, yep, to taking this on as part of their professional identity, learning to and improving on ethical, compassionate, balanced reporting, accurate reporting in this space, which makes me wonder, where does this problematic reporting come from in the first place? And maybe I might ask you, Anna, what sorts of pressures in the newsroom and values in the newsroom are journalists under that might feed into problematic stories?
Yeah, and I think it's really important that we look at this side of the story as well and bring that into the conversation because it's, you know, it's not just, you know, journalists sitting there thinking, I'm going to, you know, blow up this story or, you know, I'm going to make someone's day really bad by publishing this story. Mm. It's quite a complex picture for them as well. And I think part of it is the history, the way that schizophrenia and psychosis have always been reported. you know, it takes a lot for that to change, I think. And I think it's a case of you don't know what you don't know. And, you know, it's easier to continue with the status quo rather than educating yourself or becoming aware that, you know, that is problematic for certain reasons and there's better ways of doing things. And, you know, that's, I guess, a big reason why, as Gail mentioned before, we developed media guidelines specifically for that purpose to, I guess, address that you know, you don't know what you don't know, and increase awareness to saying, like, you know, these types of portrayals are stigmatizing, these are ways to do things better that will, you know, ideally have a less negative impact on public attitudes and beliefs and behaviours. So I think that's important, that there's a strong tradition, a strong history of complex mental illness being reported very negatively. And it takes a lot to kind of interrupt that and bring about change. But we also know, I need to caveat that I'm not a media professional and haven't worked in a newsroom, but I have spoken to some media professionals through my work and spoken about, you know, the pressures that they face in producing news stories in relation to mental illness. And I often hear, I guess there's a lot of pressure journalists work under, particularly time pressures, working to a 24/7 news cycle, is that, you know, there's pressures in newsrooms. Yeah, so demand to be, you know, producing, you know, updates on news stories as events unfold. So, yeah,
must be hard when there's no details available.
Oh,
early in the piece.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. And so much pressure to know why. Why did this happen? News audiences want to know why. Everyone's peeled to their phones these days, you know, refreshing, wanting to know what's the latest, what's happening. And, you know, and as we've heard tonight, that's often really complex and it's not something that can come out quite quickly and quite simply, you know, in a matter of minutes or hours after something occurs. So, you know, that sometimes that doesn't, you know, maybe the expectations of news audiences places additional pressure. And like you said, sometimes, you know, things are inferred that shouldn't be. We also, for example, some, you know, other journalists working for news organisations that have pressures to be raising money through advertising revenue, you know, as big part of their income.
Subscriptions, paywalls.
Absolutely, subscriptions, paywalls, you know, clicks are really important.
Can I just quickly just add, I think the second thing that we're seeing in the media more and more is, you know, in Australia we have, as I said, you know, we're leaders in stigma reduction. Our outlets predominantly are very, very good. Our journalists are very good. Mindframe does a lot of training with them, and 90% of the time the journalists all want to do the right thing. They're not deliberately doing anything bad. That doesn't always translate outside our borders. And obviously in other countries such as the US or the UK, there's very little kind of journalistic regard, I suppose, for the kind of guidelines that we have in Australia. And a lot of that content we bring in now to you know, we bring it on Newswires. We just bring content straight in. We don't adjust it. And I do have to say that a large proportion of the articles that we see in Stigma Watch that are stigmatising or harmful are more often than not from overseas. So, you know, that's an additional pressure, I think, for the newsroom, for them to be able to manage almost like that fire hose of information.
I think that's an excellent point. I completely agree. The insights I've gained through the Global Anti-Stigma Alliance have really highlighted for me that this is a global problem, and that Stigma Watch and SANE and Mindframe and Australia generally are leading the way in this space.
Yep.
So thank you for all of your good work that you're doing. I'm going to pose each of you one last question. If you had one thing that you would like the audience here tonight and those listening on ABC, Big Ideas, to take home with them from this conversation, what would it be? Maybe Anna, can I start with you?
I was going to talk to you a bit more about Mindframe's media guidelines for reporting on, like, exactly what we're talking about tonight, mental illness in relation to violence and crime. You can download those from mindframe.org.au, freely available to anyone if you wanted to check out and see what the recommendations. But I think, you know, along those lines, I think it's really important to emphasise Australia are leading the space in terms of responsible media portrayals of mental illness and suicide as well. Yeah, so I think, it's just really important that we celebrate that also.
I agree. You've put so much, you've done, and everyone involved with the Mindframe guidelines have put such solid research and work into that. They're really robust guidelines, and so that's great to remind everybody that they're available. Mm. Thank you. Gail, can I come to you?
The thing that I would love everyone to take away with them is that we don't have to sit and be victims to this, right? We can be involved. Stigma Watch, we actually have a community of almost 8,000 people now that we refer to as our Stigma Watchers that report content, whether it's media or communications content to us that they find stigmatizing or harmful, and we can act on that for them. So I strongly encourage you to get involved with Stigma Watch. Or even if you want to write a letter to an outlet yourself, there is no reason for you not to do that. If you see something that you don't agree with, write to them, tell them, this is what you should be doing. This is not the right thing to do. The other thing that I wanted to kind of emphasise as well is the best way to reduce stigma that, you know, the evidence quite clearly shows is that one-on-one, listening to someone's stories, talking to someone. Don't reinforce, don't be part of the othering. Have a conversation with someone, sit down with them, have a coffee. We have a program at SANE called the Peer Ambassador Program, and we refer to it as our living library. And we used to, unfortunately we haven't got the resources anymore, but we'd like to do it again in the future. We used to actually go to places, physical places, and allow people to take out a peer ambassador and have a conversation with them for 20 minutes. And I think that's kind of the biggest thing that we can all do, is not focus on the difference, but focus on the same.
And Tim, it's only appropriate that the final word comes from the voice of lived experience.
Well, yeah, look, well, it's about focusing on the beauty and the creativity of people. I just reflect, in 2016, myself and my peer worker friend Elise started a mad poetry at the Wollongong Writers Festival. And we had a page on a journal called Verity La, which was called Clozapine Clinic, the Freighter's story. Elise's partner, Ben, who was a surrealist poet who had a diagnosis of schizophrenia, performed marvellous performances. There was some film by the ABC, I think, that are on the net. But his book, 6 AM in the Universe, is beautiful. You know, Ben died of a clozapine overdose, age 27, and the mad poetry was in memory of him, and also not just in memory, but to give voice again to him. There is a lot of creativity out there from people who identify as mad. That is the best in writing, in art, in a whole lot of, in theatre, as I mentioned. And it's really looking at people, again, at their strengths, if given half a chance. And, you know, currently there are Red Room Poetry, which is a Sydney-based organisation, house the mad poetry stuff. And they've got, for instance, I think for about the fourth or fifth year, they're doing online mad poetry workshops, booked out solidly. People want to express themselves. People want to explore the meaning behind their world.
Okay, that'll be where we end the discussion. We've got some time for a couple of questions.
I'm wondering, does the media portrayal of issues, like the Bondi Junction incident, but any incident that hits the media, does the media portrayal of issues influence or bias how the legal system treats people who come into contact with it? And if it does, is there anything that could be done to counteract this? Because you can presumably get to people like judges or barristers and so on, impossible to get to juries, but that's you know, that's the community, isn't it? So your thoughts. Thanks.
Who would like to take that?
Here you go. I think that is an awesome question. And I think that you've kind of hit the nail on the head in a way, because there is almost that pivot point there between the media, between, you know, the judicial system, having, you know, people will end up in the forensic system, as Tim said. It's one of the things that we've discussed actually doing a little bit more work on in terms of working with court reporters in particular, because unfortunately court reporting tends to be some of the more stigmatising, and it's not necessarily due to the reporter or the outlet, it's actually due to the regulations around what they can and can't report from a court. So if we work with court reporters, I would also love to work with lawyers and judges as well. The more that we can work with them around their language and around their attitudes, the better outcome we're going to get. Yeah.
Let's get rid of those stigmatising quotes from defence lawyers.
So many stigmatising quotes from defence lawyers, yeah. but it's just the nature of the beast and the way we are. And I think, to your point, that is a really little kind of nub that we really need to look at.
Can I just sort of shift to the, like, the jails are sort of the new asylums in a way, but also want to look at the women with mental health issues often ending up in the family court and losing custody of their children on a fairly regular basis as being a bias. And that exists, yeah.
And, all right, we've got a question down the front here. Yeah.
Hi, my name is Deborah Klagas, and I have done a PhD in the experience, the stories of health professionals with adult children diagnosed with schizophrenia. And I just wanted to say that my study group consisted of mothers. And I just want to mention that mothers are still being blamed within the mental health system, within the system of which I'm a part of. And I just want to draw everybody's attention to that. And that as a result of what's happened, you know, I'm from Canada and from the United States, mothers have been creating support groups and advocacy groups all across Australia, not in Australia, but across Canada and the United States to advocate for their adult children diagnosed with schizophrenia. And I don't know if everybody knows about the term anosognosia. So over 50% of people diagnosed, no, I think it's 60% of people diagnosed with schizophrenia have anosognosia, and that means that they cannot, their brain does not function correctly, and that they do not agree that they have a mental illness, which really impedes their ability to get help. And many of them, I have a support group that I'm running right now from the Australian College of Mental Health Nurses, just for mothers like me. Mm-hmm. It's a very small group, but I mean, like, I've got to start somewhere just to provide that support for mothers, because we're really being stigmatized historically. This is historically significant issues, so I just want to raise that issue.
At SANE, we refer to our army of angry mothers, actually, is how we often refer to it, because what we see, we most commonly come into connection with family when there is a child that has been newly diagnosed or has had a situation where they've been hospitalised, and the kind of helplessness that the parents in particular tend to feel, because, you know, it doesn't matter how rich you are or how intelligent you are or how connected you are, people end up in the same place. And that kind of helplessness really drives people to want to make change. And I think from a stigma point of view, we actually have a couple of mothers at SANE who've shared their story. They share it alongside their child of their experience as well. And I think the more that we can do that, the better it is.
Thank you for that excellent question. It really highlights that stigma does radiate out to affect everyone, and all of us here are affected by stigma in one way or another in this space. Mm. We are out of time. I would like to invite you to join me in thanking our panellists for sharing their expertise.
That discussion on the complexities of covering mental illness in the news media was held at the University of Melbourne. It's an important conversation to have, and it was had as part of World Mental Health Day last year, moderated by Dr. Chris Groot from the Melbourne School of Psychological Sciences, featuring Dr. Anna Ross from the University of Melbourne's School of Population and Global Health, Gail McNaught, who manages Stigma Watch at SANE Australia, which keeps an eye on the news media, and mental health advocate Tim Heffernan, who uses his own experience as a really powerful tool for change and understanding. I'm Natasha Mitchell. It's so great to have your company for Big Ideas, ABC Radio National's live event show. You can catch up with the podcast on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts, and get in touch. bigideas@abc.net.au is our email address. bigideas@abc.net.au. I'll catch you next time. Take care. Bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.